Welcome to the Atlantic Council Events Podcast. The Atlantic Council serves the global community by bringing together world leaders, foreign policy experts, and great thinkers to shape today's policy choices and navigate the global challenges of the 21st century.
In the following program, panelists David Barno, Nora Bensahel, and Brad Carson provide a range of recommendations in three distinct time horizons to help Army leaders build the next Army successfully. The event took place on September 21st, 2016.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome and thanks for joining the Atlantic Council this morning for the rollout of the Council's new report on the future of the Army by our two senior fellows, Dave Barno and Nora Bensahel. We're excited about this morning and this discussion since clearly Dave and Nora are clearly among the best in town on this topic. So we're really looking forward to a great discussion and among the panelists, but also with you all here in the audience. I'm Magnus Nordenman. I'm the Deputy Director of the Brent Scowcroft Center here at the Council. And I just want to say a few words about why this report matters to us as an institution before I turn it over to the panel. So the Scowcroft Center here at the Council is currently building a robust program on U.S. defense policy and strategy. And this report, which is funded by the Smith-Richardson Foundation, is one of the products of that effort. So we're very happy to see it and look for more from us in the future. And obviously, as a think tank here in Washington, we not only want to respond to the issues of the day, but we also want to help the Washington policy community think beyond the current headlines and develop long-term approaches to strategic problems. And I think this report does just that by offering short, medium, and long-term visions for what American land power should look like and be prepared to do in a turbulent security environment that is in front of us. And as we all know, this is not news. This is indeed a trying time for the U.S. Army. It is coming out from over a decade of relentless combat operations around the world, and now has to contend with a rapidly changing world, along with other services, of course, that also face the same world. And this world, new world includes changing demographics, the rise of global megacities as operating environments, the proliferation of advanced technologies, and the return of geopolitical competition. And on top of all this, as we all know, resources will likely remain limited for the foreseeable future. So I think this report is a real contribution to the conversation about the future of the Army as it takes on the new and turbulent environment and what the Army must do today, tomorrow, and the day after tomorrow to successfully operate in the coming decades. So before I turn this over, we like to believe that we're an organization that's with it. So we're live tweeting this event, and you can follow along using the hashtag ACDefense, so Alpha Charlie Defense, with a hashtag in front of it. And with that, once again, welcome to the Atlantic Council this morning, and I want to turn it over to our moderator, Missy Ryan, who covers the Pentagon and national security for the Washington Post. Missy, thank you so much for being here with us this morning, and the floor is yours.
Thanks very much. Well, welcome. I'm really honored to be here with three extremely distinguished panelists. I believe you have their bios in the material that you have there. So I'm just going to jump right in, and I'd like to set the stage for our conversation about the future of the Army by both looking back and looking forward. So I'd like each of you to answer a big picture question, which is, how is the Army of today different than the Army of 2001? And how must it be different than the Army of 15 years from now? So maybe we could start with Dave.
Sure. It's almost hard to think back to what that Army looked like in, let's say, you know, the summer of 2001. I was in that Army at the time, so I have a lot of memories of that and the previous, you know, 25 years or so. And that was, in a sense, a pre-war Army. That was an Army that had come out of peacekeeping operations in the 90s. Its last big war was Desert Storm, you know, 10 years before that. And it really didn't have an entirely clear picture, as is normal, of what was going to come next. The events of 9/11 changed all that, and for the next 15 years, that Army saw itself moving from rapid combat operations at the beginning in Afghanistan and Iraq, which kind of played to its strengths, then to falling into over 15 years of counterinsurgency operations, which weren't part of its lexicon anymore. And so we've really seen the Army optimize for that in the last 15 years. The units have gotten a lot lighter. There's not as much armor and mechanized in the force. Everyone's gotten used to working off of forward operating bases with protected command and control. They've had very limited amounts of lethality directed their way. And I think 15 years from now, all that's going to be gone. I think the next Army is going to have to be prepared for what Nora and I have written about, the next big war, how we have to fight against a large competitor that has many of the advantages we have in technology and precision and lethality. And we've designed by default, for good reason, an army that doesn't do any of those things well today because of what we've been fighting in the last 10 years.
I think the biggest difference, as Dave said, is that this is a combat-tested force today after so many years at war, and a very adaptable force at the tactical level, dealing with unforeseen circumstances and dealing with unforeseen eventualities. I'm sure we'll talk about this, that adaptability is true at the organizational or at the strategic level, but certainly at the tactical level. I think one of the big ways that the Army is going to need to change for the next 15 years, because it is going to have to prepare for this next big war while also perhaps having to do counterinsurgency operations at a smaller scale elsewhere, is we need to get more Army out of the Army. And the only real way to do that is to better integrate the reserve component. That's one of the big themes of the report. We have some recommendations on how you might do that within a brigade combat team that integrates in at that level the active component and the reserve component. But we need to do a much better job of leveraging the reserve component so that we maximize the combat capability for the possible wars of the future.
That's great, and we're definitely going to get back to that. But Brett?
I think to pick up on what both Dave and Nora have said, the Army today is a lot different than 2001, although there are some trends developing within it that perhaps could harken back to that time. First of all, the use of the reserve component, completely not contemplated at the beginning of these wars in 2001, the idea that you would have people deploy for months, years at a time, multiple deployments of the Guard and Reserve, wasn't really within the common thought of how those forces would be used. And now today we've seen the excellent performance of the reserve component, and so their future will be, I think, a very robust one in the operational force. You know, at the same time, if you go back to 2001, and I was working at the Pentagon as a very young lawyer in the late 1990s, these are difficult times for all the services. The peacekeeping mission was very controversial. There was a recruiting problem in the Army, retention problem across all of the services. There were over-promotions to mid-grade officers, which led to other morale issues. This is across all of the services, but the Army is, of course, always a bellwether for these kinds of issues because of its sheer size. So I think as you go forward, the question is going to be, are we going to go back to that time, or is it going to be more like it has been the last 15 years, where you've had people join up, a strong sense of mission? You know, the amazing thing about the Army, having worked there for 4 years, last as the undersecretary, was the vast majority of the force, and everyone you met under the grade of major, joined up knowing they would be sent to Iraq or Afghanistan almost immediately upon finishing training. That's an incredible thing. Strong sense of mission, you have the Pat Tillmans, you have investment bankers who leave their jobs because they want to be part of this, you know, larger force, this great mission. As we move back into a garrison posture, as the wars wind down, you know, the recruiting retention issues are still going to, be present for us, and you already see some warning signs in that regard.
I'd like to talk about top-line numbers and just get the conversation about size of the Army out of the way. As you all know, there's been a lot of outcry from service chiefs about the impact of the sequester and the shrinking force, and within the Army about plans to bring the size of the active component down to 420,000. Is this going to be as catastrophic as some people say if the plans come to pass? How big does the Army need to be?
I think we wrote this report with the premise, much like the National Commission on the Future of the Army that came out earlier this year, with the premise that the numbers that we're seeing now, around 450 active, around 335 Guard, 195 Reserve, are about what they're going to come out at. You're citing the numbers, of course. If we go down to the BCA level of cuts with sequestration, the service chiefs and General Milley, as the Army chief, has testified that even the current levels, moving from 475 down to 450, put at high risk the nation for a lot of the contingencies we see out there. And we spent 2 hours with him here about 10 days ago on this report, and he very strongly feels that. He's committed to that those numbers mean something to him. He was up with the other chiefs last week testifying in readiness again on the Hill. So trying to translate into something that means anything to congressmen or even the American people today is very, very difficult in the world that we're in, with limited threats that would appear on the horizon as opposed to really existential threats right in front of us. So I think generally we're arguing that this report's premised on the Army at about, you know, 450 active, about 335 on the reserve side of the house and guard with the reserve about 195. If those numbers go lower, you are going to see a lot more risk out there. So, and we talk about how to use what we have perhaps more effectively in that arena.
Yeah, that's what I was going to emphasize. You know, the risks would certainly go up. The smaller the Army gets, the greater the risk. There's no way around that trade-off. But one thing that the Army can control, because it can't control whether sequestration is going to happen or not, right? That's entirely dependent on Congress. Mm-hmm. A lot of our recommendations are designed to put more of the people who are in uniform in combat positions, to get more combat capability of the end strength that you do have, which we think is vital at 450,000 as active duty end strength. It would certainly be even more true later on, freeing up people from doing all sorts of things that the Army has to do, but that are not directly related to combat, so you can free more people to serve in brigade combat teams and so on, is going to be essential at whatever the future size of the Army is going to be.
And Brad, is there anything you can say about how the leadership within the Pentagon, you know, has seen this in the recent past, this issue?
I come at it from both having spent a lot of years in the Army and then most recently in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. And I think, as Dave said, they're settling around the 980,000 total Army number, with 450,000 in the active component and the rest in the reserve component. I mean, the truth of it is, right, the Army models will tell you that they need 1.3, 1.4 million people in the U.S. Army if they're going to meet all of their missions with acceptable dwell to deploy times and all these kinds of things. So really the question always, if you're a senior leader of the Army, whether in uniform or not, is what kind of risk you're going to take, because you're never probably going to have enough people to do all of the things you might be called upon to do. And I think, you know, the million person number is about right. I think one thing, since we have a lot of Army officers in the room here, the challenge for the Army, it seems to me, going forward is, even if sequestration is lifted and more money comes to the Pentagon, right, the real question is going to be, does the Army get much of it? Because, you know, across the Pentagon, although the Army has had tough times in the last 4 or 5 years in the budget battles, most people would recognize, you know, we'd like to have a larger Army than a smaller one. The Army is probably getting smaller than we would desire for our planning. But of course, we have the Ohio-class submarine and the long-range bomber and the KC-46. And I mean, right, major programs, when you look at it, you say, well, there are other fights that we might need these other very expensive weapons systems. These other services might have a greater role in them. And so I think that's what's one of the great things about this report is it's placing the Army in a broader context of what the future missions of the United States military are going to be and makes a case for the Army's role in them. I think that's something the Army has struggled with over the last 5 years coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan is, you know, if the future is China, Asia Pacific, littoral combat, you know, what's the role for the Army in this? And the Army's had a hard time answering that. The Navy and the Air Force could quickly give some answers to that question, and therefore, right, they had a compelling narrative to justify their budgets. I think that's what the Army needs to do a bit better on. And the 980 number, again, we'd love to have more, but that seems like a stable place for us.
One thing, if I could add on that, I think one of the things we also were very clear on in the report, and we don't get into a lot of talk on, you know, strategy, resources, mismatch, we kind of accept where we are, but the reality is that the current funding levels were premised on the 2011 Budget Control Act, which was premised on a different strategic environment than the one we're in right now. In the last 4 or 5 years, what we've seen transpire, you know, with the Chinese and the South China Sea and the East China Sea, with the Russians in Crimea and Eastern Europe, in the Middle East with ISIS and a number of other rising threats, that's not the world of 2011. And yet we still have both the dollars and in some ways the strategy of 2011. So there's a point in time where you may have to revisit that. We're not seeing that happen under the current political climate. So the bottom line becomes, how do you get more with what you have? How do you at least maximize your assets, that 980,000, to get the most out of that you possibly can with what you've got? Because again, the politics probably, until something draconian happens, or may not shift that too much.
Yeah, and there are a lot of detailed, imaginative recommendations in the report for doing that. And actually, building on what you just said, one of the central themes of the report is the fact that the United States, it looks like we're entering an era of perpetual war, which may include these open-ended gray zone conflicts. Think about the Islamic State, Boko Haram, militant groups from North Africa to East Asia. And also potentially great power conflicts. Think about Russia in Crimea, the rise of China, the South China Sea. I guess, Nora, I would direct this question to you. How ready is the Army now to face that threat?
The Army has done a very good job of, through the recent combat experiences, preparing for the perpetual war types of conflicts we may, you know, that we're in and that we're going to continue to be in. The kinds of gray zone conflicts that we're seeing today against ISIS are tailor-made particularly for special forces. Mm-hmm. And we argue in the report that demand for special operations forces, true across all the services, but of course the report focuses on the Army, so the demand for Army special operations forces is only going to go up. We recommend reversing some of the cuts that have been made to special operations forces, for example, and putting it on a modest growth path. Recognizing there's only so much you can grow special operations forces, but still very small amounts of growth are probably a good thing. Because the fight against ISIS isn't going to be over tomorrow. It isn't going to be over in a year. ISIS as a group itself may be defeated, but the threat from the ideology is going to continue, you know, perhaps for a generations-long struggle. So there will be a piece of the Army, and some conventional forces will be a part of that, that will always need to be ready for that. And I think that they're at a very good level of being able to deal with that now. But again, when you look towards the future, while that's going on, the Army needs to take seriously preparing for whatever the next big war is, right? That doesn't mean that a conflict with Russia or China is inevitable, far from it, but it is the job of a defense planner to prepare for the, you know, most damaging circumstances for U.S. national security. And that's where we think the Army has a lot of room to change and transform itself. To its great credit, it's already doing a lot of those things, but that's going to need to continue at the same time that it remains engaged in the continuing wars in the gray zone.
Sure, Dave, I guess I would ask you, can you talk about what the niche strengths of Army Special Operations Forces, how those will be relevant, those strengths will be relevant in today's battlefield versus Special Operations Forces from other services?
The Army, of course, is the predominant contributor to U.S. Special Operations Forces. Somewhere around 70% of the U.S. SOF are Army soldiers. And there are Army Rangers who do direct action missions, Army Special Forces who do a variety of missions to include Security Force Assistance, which I want to come back to. Army Special Operations Aviation, I had a son served in that unit for a number of years, who moved these folks around on the battlefield in very demanding environments. And some special mission units, some civil affairs, some military information, or formerly PSYOP units out there. So a wide array of units that the Army contributes, different from what the SEALs do, different from what Marine Special Operations do, different from what the Air Force Special Ops does, mostly in the lift and delivery side of the house, as you would expect. Where the Army makes a big contribution, where the Army has an enduring mission that we make a specific recommendation on how to get at, is how you provide security force assistance to other countries, how you build other nations' militaries, how you help them build the institutions of the military so they support democratic principles and the rule of law. We find Army forces doing that all over the world. Today, the Army is breaking brigade combat teams into pieces, retraining them for that mission, sending them to Iraq and Afghanistan to do that for 9 months, bringing them back and putting them back together again to make a brigade combat team to fight big wars. We say essentially that makes no sense. You need to actually, you've got an enduring mission for security force assistance, build some force structure that does security force assistance, have several security force assistance brigades that are comprised of mid-grade officers and NCOs that are already experienced. They can go out there, they can do this, they can come in for 3 years in that capacity from a regular unit, then go back to a regular unit and bring that experience back. But don't continue to break your major combat units, give them ad hoc training to go do this, which is a very key specialty to learn, and then put them back together again as a tank, you know, or armored brigade combat team. That's what the Army's doing today. So in addition to continuing to grow SOF a little bit, we think that the Army's got to actually dedicate some force structure to this enduring mission of security force assistance that does a couple of things for them as well.
Yeah, I was just going to add to that. You know, this is not the idea of an advisor corps of old. This is not people who are going to be dedicated to that throughout their career. You would rotate people in and out. But it has a very important secondary benefit, which is just as important as to why these things, the security force assistant brigades, are such an important idea. They provide the core of units that could be used to grow new units if the Army does need to expand quickly in any future contingency. Mm-hmm. The people that you need for security force assistance, the reason why you have to break a BCT and waste all of that investment in its readiness is because security force assistance missions require mid-career personnel. You don't put a private out there to do it. You need officers of mid-rank, majors, lieutenant colonels, and some colonels, and their counterpart enlisted personnel with that much experience experience. So in addition to preserving BCTs by having these new Security Force Assistant Brigades, you know, they wouldn't be fully manned with the full complement of BCT personnel. They would be manned with those people who are most needed for Security Force Assistance. Sure. If you have to build new units, it is not easy, but it is relatively easy to build a private, right? It takes a few weeks, you can do it, it's not an easy thing. What you cannot replace quickly is the experienced leadership of those officers and senior NCOs. And so having their day-to-day mission be Security Force Assistance gives them something to do that is a vital mission for the Army, help save readiness, but you're also preserving a cadre core in case you need to expand rapidly. And so you get really, you're preparing, you're maintaining readiness in the present and trying to solve what will be a very difficult problem if you need it in the future.
Okay. I want to talk a little bit more about Security Force Assistance, but first I want to ask Brad, you know, you mentioned budget battles and prioritization of resources. How much support do you think there would be within the Pentagon and on Capitol Hill for growing the size of Army Special Operations Forces and you know, building up these teams that Nora's talking about?
I think Capitol Hill has a great affection for special forces. I think the larger public does. I can see considerable support for it. Now, the institutional army, I think, could have more ambivalence about it. And that goes to kind of maybe a lot of the kind of things that what Dave and Nora have written about. You know, if you're going to be a critic at all of some of the proposals, and I'm not, I think they're, I'm a wholehearted supporter of every recommendation they make, it is we have 980,000 people. We have 28 BCTs in the active component. And most people will tell you that that's not enough BCTs to deal with possible kinetic operations against major threats like a North Korea or a Russia or something like that. So if you grow special forces, right, that's at a cost to someone out there. And so it's not that special operators aren't terrific in what they do. I think you would see a bit of ambivalence to say, well, where are you going to find these people from? And right, that we may need them in another unit instead. And I think that's where I think the question is going to be is kind of like, you know, who's the bill payer if the end strength remains flat?
Okay. Going back to Security Force Assistance, I thought the recommendation to accelerate the development of these Security Force Assistance Brigades was really interesting. But it, as someone who covers the military, it was also interesting to me because recently, I've seen a lot of skepticism at the senior leadership within the Pentagon, not just the Army, about the enduring capability of the United States military and the United States generally to sort of affect transformational change in foreign security forces and, you know, foreign countries. If you think about the experience of Iraq in 2014 when much of the Iraqi army collapsed and then some of the ongoing struggles that the United States has had in Afghanistan, even after, you know, investing years and billions of dollars in trying to build up the ANSF. How do you square those two, you know, the objective to, you know, really support these forces that can be partners against against terrorist threats in a more effective way with the sort of unanswered question that I think many of us have, which is, you know, how much can we actually do to transform the trajectory of these other countries?
Yeah, I guess my take on that would be, and I have a little bit of experience that in the Afghanistan arena, would be we don't have a choice. We don't have an alternative. I was just thinking as you were speaking there that a number of years ago when Mike Mullen was the Chief of Naval Operations, I think on his watch, they instituted an idea that's kind of gone away in terminology called the 1,000-ship Navy. And the 1,000-ship Navy wasn't 1,000 gray boats that had U.S. flags flying off stern. It was 300 U.S. ships with 700 ships from all the other countries that were our friends and allies around the world. So this idea that we, with our own forces, can do, you know, with U.S. troops, which we did in Iraq for a long time, we did in Afghanistan for a long time, and we can do in perpetuity in just two countries, that tapped out the U.S. military almost entirely to fight counterinsurgency fights there. We have to consider that there's counterinsurgency fights that are in our interest to fight in 10, 15, 20, 35 countries around the world. Those can't be American troops. So we don't really have much of a choice other than to find ways to try and make those nations' militaries more effective to advance and protect our own interests. I think the alternative is unsupportable. So I would agree the results are mixed. The results are more mixed when we do it episodically. We start, we stop, we start, we stop, obviously. So some type of an enduring commitment to do this and in professionalizing this, which is what we're suggesting with Security Force Assistance Brigade. We've done it almost exclusively ad hoc for 15 years. may not have been the right approach, might have had a slightly different outcome if it was a force that had coherence over that entire period of time and was going to do it for a long time.
I think a lot of the skepticism about security force assistance comes from the experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's right to question a lot of that, but that's not actually the typical security force assistance mission. We've done this, you know, long before 2001 and through these wars with a wide variety of friendly countries and other states that asked for U.S. help. So it doesn't necessarily need to be at the scale. We're not talking about building, you know, militaries from scratch, right, the way that we did in Iraq and Afghanistan. There will certainly be security force assistance requirements continuing in both Iraq and Afghanistan, but that's not the kind of daily missions that we're talking about. We're talking about working with, you know, friendly forces who have asked for U.S. help to improve their capabilities most of all.
Okay. Brad, did you want to add anything?
I think just to pick up what they said, the U.S. Army is deployed in 150 countries, and in most of those places, right, the grand ambitions of Iraq and Afghanistan aren't present. Right, we're working with militaries to improve their own professionalism, improving civil-military relations, phase zero operations to hope keep us out of a more kinetic form of conflict. I mean, that's more typical for what the U.S. Army is doing around the globe. I think there's great success that's been had in those, even if we are perhaps have controversies about how Iraq and Afghanistan have gone.
Okay. Well, let's. We have about 15 more minutes of questions that we're going to do up here on the panel, and then we're going to open it up to the audience. So let's talk about how the Army can make sure it's ready to fight conventional wars effectively. You have some recommendations, not the coin wars, but if there was, you know, a ground war against Russia or something like that, what does the Army need to do in order to make sure that it's ready to do so in the way that would be required in the 21st century?
We've actually written some of our columns at War on the Rocks on this as well. We wrote one called the Military's Protection Deficit Disorder here a few weeks ago. And that's one of the domains, as I mentioned at the very beginning this morning, that the Army has kind of lost its ability to operate in a high-intensity, high-end conflict. I characterized that to General Milley last week as we have small war syndrome. We've been fighting small wars since 9/11. We've gotten very good at fighting small wars. We operate off forward operating bases. We have protected bunkers. We have bottled water we bring into everyone in the field. We don't live in tents and foxholes, and we have a very structured, protected way of doing business. We haven't had to be on the receiving end of precision weaponry. We haven't been on the receiving end of drones firing Hellfire missiles. We haven't had to, you know, take on big rocket attacks and dig in underneath protective cover to survive those as we did in the Cold War. So a lot of the Cold War skills we've lost. So one of the things we suggest in here is there's a number of things you need to reinstitute to be able to protect yourselves. Those include, you know, nuclear, biological, and chemical protection from suits to training to reporting to operating in those environments. They include having the ability to actually defeat drones, lethal drones, non-lethal drones that are going to be used against you. We're starting to actually have to do a bit of that in Iraq right now with ISIS, believe it or not. And also the ability to survive under heavy fire, indirect fires, whether it's rockets, you know, precision weapons, long-range cruise missiles. We've seen the Russians launch long-range cruise missiles into Syria. We could be on the receiving end of that someday. So we're going to have to rebuild a lot of these skills for how to fight these wars, how to protect ourselves, and add new technology into them. How do you defeat, you know, precision weapons that are coming in volume against you? We're just beginning in the Army to field some nascent weapons that can do that. This has not even been on the portfolio for the last 15 years.
Okay. I would add to that we need to improve our armored capabilities. As Dave mentioned earlier, the force has gotten very light, which was an appropriate response to the wars that we've been in, but we don't have enough active armored BCTs. We recommend increasing the numbers of those, transitioning some infantry BCTs into armored BCTs. But there are also a lot of technical things that aren't glamorous, that don't involve capabilities that the Army can be doing now to prepare. One of our recommendations is to develop a plan to inventory surplus equipment and weaponry. Again, if you need to regrow the force fast, it would be a good idea to have a really solid plan of what equipment is mothballed and plans for how you would bring it up to speed quickly if you could. Another thing is to look at mobilization as a whole. If you really had to mobilize, again, we're not just talking about mobilizing the reserve component here. We're pretty good at that when we need to be. But how do you, you know, do a much broader mobilization that needs to tap into the population? Again, these are not going to be easy, and the plan itself, you know, may or may not be applicable in whatever future scenario we're in. But the planning process, you know, the military sort of lives by that you know, the plans may be nothing, but the planning is everything, right? Common military saying. A lot of those types of things are things that the Army can and must be doing now to at least facilitate it if, you know, in the event that this, that we need to activate those plans, that we can at least have some basis to do it rather than doing it on a totally ad hoc basis after some sort of national emergency has happened.
One of the things that we noted here also, I could add, is that and this is a big difference from 15 years ago, 20 years ago, 25 years ago. The U.S. Army today lives at home. It's got a U.S. zip code behind mm-hmm. its address. That was not the case during the Cold War when a third of the Army was stationed overseas and it was pushed up against your potential adversaries already in position with lots of heavy weaponry training, which provided a lot of reassurance for our allies there against, in that case, the Soviet Union or perhaps North Koreans or the Chinese. Today, the Army lives at home. And so the Army is going has a one could argue, and we note in the report, in a way the Army is strategically malpositioned for the world right now because it has to commute to the fight. You've got to get your Army out to where the fight's going to take place, and now you're going to probably have to do that in a contested environment. So we suggest that the Army and Joint Force has to think about how to fight for staging areas, how to be able to perhaps maneuver on land to get staging areas where you can bring additional reinforcements in, because those troops don't live overseas anymore with all their weaponry. You've got to bring that for the United States. So being able to deploy rapidly, regenerate our capabilities there, look at our forward stationing. We suggest that we need to start making the argument for more forward stationed mm-hmm. Army forces, which we've been going in the opposite mm-hmm. direction for 15 years now. And that we also need to think about prepositioning again and be able to protect those prepositioned stocks from all manner of threats that we didn't have to worry as much about when we had that system going during the Cold War.
Great. Well, Brad, I'm going to ask you the really tough question regarding some of the suggestions which would require acquiring new capabilities or technology. How would one pay for all of this if, you know, given the current resource environment?
I mean, there'll have to be difficult trade-offs. You know, a new armored BCT is a couple of $1 billion just to equip it, and to operate it each year is no doubt hundreds of millions of dollars. And so there have to be trade-offs. And maybe it comes back to the previous question. On the broadest level, the challenge the Army faces and the challenge the Department of Defense faces is, as Gordon Sullivan once said, more intellectual than physical, right? The Army has to think a lot about what future conflict is going to look like, who it's going to be against, what you'll need to do that, right? And what you're not going to be able to do, because you can't do every single thing. In the same way that the Department of Defense and maybe the broader National Command Authority has lost, I think, the threat about deterrence over the last 30 years. We didn't have to worry about that. And so right today, perhaps if our plan to deter, say, Russia, is that if they are aggressive in Eastern Europe, we'll put people on ro-ros and planes, right, and find some way there. But that's a lot different than having people, you know, BCT in Estonia, right? That has a different deterrent effect. Mm-hmm. And I think we've lost our coherent thinking about that. So it comes back to this question of the Army has to decide kind of what the future is going to look like, how you hedge against multiple contingencies in that unknowable realm, but trying to place some strategic bets. And then we have to think through more about like how we use the military against the adversaries that we perceive as rising or that we're going to have to deal with. Those are really serious challenges, not easy. I mean, running the Army is extraordinarily difficult, and the planning for it is really, really challenging for all of those reasons. It's very technical. There are a lot of questions about, like, you know, kit and formations, et cetera. But they all fall out of these kind of broad philosophical inquiries into what the world's going to be in 20 years, 30 years. And that is, right, can fool the greatest of minds.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to add that the structure of the report is such that not all of our recommendations are meant to be implemented today, right?
Yeah.
We recognize
right.
those trade-offs. We recognize that you know, the money isn't there, even though we would love to do all of those things today. Mm-hmm. So there is some, you know, we did break it out sort of by timeline, you know, what we think the Army needs to get done in the next 4 years through 2020, then recommendations for the midterm 2020 to 2025, and then 2025 and beyond. All of them, though, have some element of things that need to be done today. The equipment, as you mentioned, that's going to be obviously the most expensive and involve the most trade-offs. Mm-hmm. But some of the recommendations for those longer time frames that we need to start now are in the realm of planning. And those are the things I think that, you know, that some of the things I was mentioning before,
sure.
those are things that don't cost money, that, you know, are still difficult to do, but that can be done even under very difficult resource constraints.
Okay. May I add something? Yeah, constructive criticism of the report. My personal favorite recommendation, although it's not the most significant, is, of course, that we should no longer wear reflector belts in garrison when we're out doing PT. My criticism is you put it into the far future. I suggest we have immediate action from the Chief of Staff of the Army to no longer require us to wear reflector belts.
Can we tell a great story from the report? One of our personal favorites, again, it's not the most important, but we discovered and we put in the report, this is on the section on changing Army culture, which is something we haven't talked a lot about here, but Dave and I wrote one of our columns on War on the Rocks, and I'm guessing there'll be some questions based on that. We discovered that the Army sent out a safety message to everyone in the United States Army about the dangers of playing Pokemon Go.
yes,
you know, because it's very dangerous, because, you know, you have to cross streets. We got a comment on our War on the Rocks column, someone, you know, we don't know who it is, you know, pseudonym online, talking about, but that is extremely important because there was a senior NCO who was killed last year because he was running on, I kid you not, you can look at this, it's on our website, because this guy was killed while he was running on railroad tracks wearing headphones. Now, I have a lot of sympathy. I mean, that's a terrible thing, but at a certain point, common sense has to prevail. You know, and we talk about this, about the culture of just an absolute lack of risk tolerance among the very people that we are asking to lead our troops in combat on the front lines, where they aren't going to have, you know, folks from above telling them that, you know, playing Pokemon Go
right.
can be extraordinarily dangerous. And so, you know, maybe I'm wondering after that comment, like, you know, we need a safety gram on, you know, don't wear your headphones while you're running
exactly.
on railroad tracks.
There's an Alarak on it already. I'm sure.
I mean, these sound like small things, and we can all laugh at them, but they're reflective of a much broader problem that we do think is very dangerous
yes,
for the Army in the future.
I want to move on to the culture in the final few minutes, but just really quickly, can one of you tell me about the recommendation to integrate the active reserve and guard components more regularly? How would this work, and what does this gain?
Yeah, I think one of the signature recommendations in the report that the Army is not doing right now, although it's flirting with the edges of it, is to actually integrate active duty Army National Guard and Army Reserve units inside of a brigade combat team.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually have a diagram in the report of a proposed armored brigade combat team that has integrated units. And essentially, you'll see in the report that in this notional brigade combat team, you'd have a mixed headquarters of all three components, a number of the battalion headquarters would be mixed, but the combined arms battalions, they'd have, you know, two of those, I think, active duty, an artillery battalion that would be a National Guard, another National Guard cavalry squadron, some mixture where you have significant integration at the Army's most important fighting unit. The Army has advanced a program in the last few months called the Associated Units Program. We talked to General Milley about that. We went down to Forces Command in North Carolina to talk to them about it. It in some ways is too little too late, I think. It's not going to produce results till 2019. And one of the things that's missing there is any chain of command that's unified between three components. So we go into some detail about why actually taking a number of brigade combat teams and integrating them with all three components would be beneficial, not only to change the culture to get more Army out of the Army, but also to reduce the cost. An armored brigade combat team that had perhaps a third to what half National Guard and Army Reserve would be less expensive to maintain, and it could be kept at a higher readiness than a purely National Guard Armored Brigade Combat Team. So we thought that was an excellent way to get at this idea of making this truly one Army, as opposed to, you know, what we're seeing with the associated unit structure.
And I want to talk a little bit about some of the assumptions that helped get us to why we think this is one of the signature recommendations of the report. We're looking at the current environment today, right? And anybody who studied strategy, right? Strategy is the relationship between ends, ways, and means, right? Well, the Army doesn't get to pick the ends. That's picked by political leaders and national strategy. We do have an election coming up, and some of the contours, you know, may be very different between the candidates. But you know, no matter who wins the election, we don't think that the ends are fundamentally going to change. That the U.S. is still going to remain engaged around the world and have to operate around the world. It may do so in different ways, but we don't think that core principle is likely to change. And we don't think that the means are going to change, right? Because Congress controls the means. That's the money available to do these things. And we don't see, barring some spectacular change in the alignment of Congress, which I don't think is particularly likely, that the Budget Control Act is going to be fundamentally changed. So we start from the assumption that the ends are relatively fixed and the Army doesn't get to vote on those, and the means are relatively fixed and the Army doesn't get to vote on those. Mm-hmm. So what that means is that what the Army has to control is the ways, how you make them match. It's not a wonderful position to be in. I think we'd all love the Army's ends, the means to match the ends more, but we don't assume they're going to because we don't see the political alignment doing that. This idea of a hybrid brigade and being able to draw the reserve component in is a way to try to square that circle of coming up with different ways of doing things given those very fundamental constraints on both the ends and the means. And we think this is one of the best ways to, as we said earlier, to get more Army out of the Army, because you don't have the choice of saying, well, we're going to, you know, increase the size of the Army to 1.3 or 1.4 million people.
Okay, great. Well, let's move on to one of the central long-term recommendations, which is to transform the Army's culture. You recommend, among other things, reforming the bureaucracy, trying to get the Army to accept more risk, leadership to employ greater imagination, out-of-the-box thinking. Brad, this question is for you. How do you incentivize rising leaders within the Army to take on greater risk and to come up with potentially out-of-the-box proposals that might be risky for their own careers in an organization that, you know, isn't known for rewarding those qualities?
The organization does reward those qualities in the field, I think, right? You find young officers, right, who've done amazing innovations on the fly, great tactical successes. I think the operational Army does reward that. Perhaps as you get higher up into the Army, right, that's a less valorized quality. But I think we do recognize it at times. I mean, it's a very hard thing. Any organization struggles with this, especially one as large, as bureaucratic as the U.S. Army. So it's not about the Army. It's just about large organizations with, you know, two centuries of glorious history behind it. I think there are things you can probably do, and it starts with the leaders at the top encouraging it. It's about protecting the dissidents underneath you. You know, I think if you ask me what one of my most important jobs as a civilian leader of the Army was, it was to find the Army officers who perhaps had a divergent viewpoint from the orthodoxy, right, and trying to get them into positions where they could be recognized and their careers would be enhanced as your SIG chief, as your XO, as these kind of things, right? Mm-hmm. You promote them up where you hope that they'll be able to then move even higher up into the echelon. It's about tolerating a culture of failure, right? Because to innovate is to have failures, more failures than successes. Right. So I think there are ways to do it. It's a very hard thing. I mean, the culture is the sum of all decisions the organization has ever made. And so to change it is a really hard thing. But the good news to me about the Army is all of the ingredients for maybe a slightly more innovative, open culture are there. You know, there's incredible intellectual ferment in many places in the Army. You know, we send people off to the best schools, there are PhDs all around the Army, a lot of writing. You know, you have these journals where young officers on their own time, right, are writing about force structure and the future. I mean, really incredible intellectual ferment, right? You have to encourage that, you have to develop it, you have to promote those people up, you have to ensure that senior leaders are listening to them. These are the kind of things you have to do. It's not an easy project to change a culture. But I think it's a very important one, and the ingredients are there to do it.
Okay, we're going to open it up, but really quick, do you want to add anything else on culture, either of you?
I think the only thing I would emphasize is that in a lot of ways what we're describing in the operational Army is the mission command culture, where you give broad guidance, you establish what the objectives are, and you encourage your subordinates to be creative and innovative to find ways to get to that objective. That doesn't exist in the institutional Army, the at-home Army, the garrison Army, and in fact almost all the procedures and processes in that Army flow the other way. So there's kind of an internal cultural clash that occurs every day in the Army between I'm being told to take the initiative to come up with innovative ways to take the hill. At the same time, I have to get my automobile inspected before I go on a three-day weekend, even though, and this is another true story that we got in as a result of our column, a lieutenant colonel in one of the Army's major posts who was going on a three-day weekend recently had to have her car inspected for almost an hour before she, as a former battalion commander who had deployed to combat, could drive out for a three-day trip in the U.S. And that didn't include the time to file a trip report on where you were going and do all the safety briefings as part of that. So this same culture that wants you to take risks in combat is the one that requires even commanders, experienced commanders that are 42 years old, to go through this arcane process in garrison in peacetime. And somehow the Army's got to square that circle, because as the wars get less prevalent, the garrison mentality gets more prevalent.
I would quickly respond to your comment on the intellectual ferment in the Army. I think that it is there, and there are individuals who are doing that, but the service as a whole is not rewarding that the way that it needs to. The senior leaders of the Army, the current ones and past ones, to their credit, are emphasizing this as important, broadening opportunities, taking a position somewhere else in the government, attending civilian graduate school. We emphasize this as critically important for the future of the Army, because military master's degrees occur in classrooms where everybody looks exactly the same, has the same kinds of background. You need to be in a civilian graduate school to really broaden your thinking and be exposed to people who don't think like you. A quick footnote on this. This is one of my favorite recommendations, because this one doesn't require any money, because people have, those who serve today, have incredibly generous educational benefits through the GI Bill. They don't need the opportunities to be funded. They just need the opportunities to go. But so the senior leaders are saying the right things, but there's a lot in the middle that is blocking that. There's a lot of, you know, folks in the middle of the chain of command that are blocking their people from doing this because it puts them at a disadvantage for their current rotation at the National Training Center or somewhere else. And we hear over and over again from junior personnel that on this particular issue, the audio and the video don't match. Right, you know, they're being punished by promotion boards for doing these things. They're, even though the senior leaders very much are saying this is important, and so we draw that out as a very important recommendation here, that that's a part of the Army culture that definitely needs to change.
Let me just add to that, because I have all the scars to show for those recommendations for sure. I'm a huge supporter of all of those ideas, whether it's civilian schooling, whether it's more graduate degrees across the board, broadening experiences like you all being here today, being an example of that. You know, it becomes a system problem, though, right? The reason more people don't do that is because the system punishes you for it, and it does it because, right, the treadmill is very fast. If you want to go off and spend 4 years getting your PhD, you're going to miss, right, some key and developmental positions that will hurt you later on in your career. That's why you have to change the whole system, right? It's very hard to kind of say, hey, we want more people with PhDs. Yeah, we also want people with battalion command, right, to be brigade commanders, and, right, these things suddenly don't square, as Dave said. And that's the real challenge I think the Army has. But you know what? It can be done. I mean, I'm a Navy guy myself. Right? I always love to read in the Navy Times that the Navy will put in some new rule, and something like the next year, like every enlisted sailor will have done that thing. Like this year, the promotions are going to be, you have to do X to get promoted. And something like the whole Navy like congregates and does that. You know, if you had senior leaders in the Army, say, like, you know, here's what we want. We are going to promote brigade commanders, and we want you to have a PhD to do it. For example, just pick a kind of out there example, right? You find a lot of people start applying to graduate programs, you know, and make that happen. You know, and senior leaders have the ability to do that. And that's, I think, what you have to kind of shock the system if you're a senior leader is. The promotion boards can be, right, they have to be approved by someone. They don't just exist on there. They're not autonomous. You know, I mean, we accept the promotions that the system generates. And therefore, if you don't like it, we should intervene and say, hey, I mean it, man. You know, you got to do this, this, and this. And if we want you to go be a MEP leader in Iraq, right, then, hey, you know, and we're going to say you're going to promote you, we'll make sure it happens. That's what you can do. So, I mean, I think in many ways, having been a senior leader myself, I can say that, you know, we abdicate our responsibility to do these kind of things. It's difficult. It's politically sensitive. You have to really know what you want to do and not just be kind of gliding along, but you can shock it into doing better things.
All right. Well, I know people have questions, so let's open it up. There are people who have microphones, and please, when you ask a question, identify yourself, state your affiliation, and make sure that your question is a question. So there's a gentleman over here on the side, I think we'll begin with him, who had his hand up.
Oh, thank you. Richard Downey from Delphi Strategic Consulting, and thanks for a very interesting discussion. I look forward to reading the report. You talked about the recommendation about creating a security force assistance brigade, which in this era of tight budget strikes me as a very logical approach to break, as opposed to breaking down combat brigades and then reconstituting them. You also mentioned that you had talked to General Milley and other members of the Army leadership about while you're doing this report. I wonder how receptive, given the structural change that recommendation in particular would require, how receptive were they with a recommendation like that? Thank you.
So that's one that General Milley is already pursuing, and there's been press reports on that. You know, he had talked about those last fall and is actually starting to create them. So, you know, that's why we talk in our report about accelerating the development of these and perhaps experimenting with a couple of different models of how you might do it so that, you know, you can engage in more learning and field them more quickly. But we saw a great deal of receptivity, again, because, you know, readiness is such an issue for the Army, as it always has to be, and for exactly, you know, what you highlighted, because these kinds of things will help preserve readiness for the possible big wars, something which in the current security environment, again, as Dave mentioned before, very different from 5 years ago. I mean, that's really, you know, a much more of a serious possibility. We saw a lot of receptivity to those ideas. Now, of course, the devil is always in the details, and when these things get implemented, there's going to be a lot of gnashing, and the system is, you know, going to, you know, find problems, and other things will have to be adjusted. That's one of the reasons why we encourage more experimentation as these are rolled out, to try to work those problems out as quickly as possible.
I just add briefly, we actually started thinking about this report about two and a half years ago, and our original aim point was the new chief of staff in September of last year, that when he walked in, he would have this. We had some changes in where we were, you know, cited. We're up at American University now, and other things that delayed that a bit. But it's actually worked out much better because, in all candor, the last chief of staff was not at all a fan of this idea of advisor assist brigades or force structure for security, force assistance, and probably most of the other things in this report. Whereas the current chief of staff, just from reading, you know, talking to him obviously, but reading a number of the announcements and things he's working on in the Army Times and other places, is moving in some very different directions and clearly sees a need to have some enduring force structure for an enduring mission, and sees the cost of not, you know, being able to maintain your BCTs at top readiness to fight in the world he happens to be in. A different world, of course, than 4 years ago. So actually the timing on this is very propitious, and there's a lot of echoing and rhyming going on with things that we're seeing General Milley moving forward on after 1 year in his job right now.
I'm Harlan Ulmer with the Atlantic Council. Thank you. Dave, I think you and Nora have written an excellent report. And my question is it possible that you've understated the challenges ahead two ways? First, I would assert that sequestration is far less a problem than uncontrollable internal cost growth in the Pentagon that's running at 5 to 7% a year, which means if the budget doesn't increase by $30 to $40 billion a year, we're stuck. The chiefs made this point before the McCain committee last week. And so I think we're approaching a hollow force, whether we like it or not, during the next administration. Second, I think the 4+1 matrix that we need to be able to defeat one at a time, deter or defeat Russia, China, Iran, or North Korea, plus fight the Islamic State, is completely unworkable. So how do you envisage the U.S. Army being able to deter and, if necessary, defeat Russia or China in a war that could be nuclear, in which I don't think we're going to have any allies, and in which I think it's very unlikely that NATO is going to shift its posture to what it was during the Cold War?
We've written about the issue of internal cost growth in our previous life at Center for New American Security. Kate Kidder, one of our co-authors on several of those reports, is here in the audience today as well. And it's a huge problem. It's not a problem that's going to go away. Fortunately, we've seen some minor relief in that in terms of where inflation's been very relatively flat, same thing with fuel costs, et cetera. But the costs of pay, benefits, health care, and other things are consuming the defense budget from within. So your buying power of that dollar, which is relatively on a slower flat ascent right now, is pretty modest. Don't have an answer for that. We proposed a number of things in our previous reports in terms of defense reform. You know, there hasn't been too much movement forward on any of those. Your second question, I think, is more problematic, and it's a very dark scenario, clearly. And I think all the service chiefs and probably the Army chief most of all realizes we're probably not prepared for that world. We don't have the ability to fight and either sequentially or simultaneously two or three of those potential fights out there, and any of those things could actually take place. And that's probably with mobilizing the entire reserve component, all the Guard and all the Army Reserve, to get them into that fight. That still would be a stretch for the Army to do that. And that's one of the reasons General Milley is harping on, you know, high risk in terms of his readiness right now against these conflicts. So I think there's a answer out that in that, that if you're in a multiple front war of that size, you start having to expand your army, and we talk quite a bit about what you have to do to get ready for the next big war, which is a lot of what I think you're describing with that darker scenario.
Yeah, and if that darker scenario comes to pass, we're going to have to be in a different national climate. Right, and we're going to have to be involved in some element of national mobilization in growing the army quickly and in doing all sorts of things that certainly in the past 15 years of war, the American population was not asked to do. Obviously, that's a challenge for political leaders going forward. Many of our recommendations, as I said, are trying to get the army to do as much of it as it can ahead of time to plan and prepare that. But that strategic context, there's no way that the army of today at its current size is going to be able to address, because that's not where the national debate and national discussion is about preparing for the future.
Brian, did you want to add anything?
Those are both difficult questions. I mean, let's talk about just the cost growth for a moment, because I have spent a lot of time on that issue. The planning constructs are worthy of another session entirely in how we think about force structure relative to them. No one wants to do the hard work. I mean, yes, it's true, right? Compensation is increasing year on, year out. Are people wanting to cut it? Congress doesn't want to. The military service organizations and veteran service organizations don't support it. Healthcare is $50 billion a year, nearly 10% of the DoD budget. It has fallen slightly in the last couple of years as force structure itself has fallen. It's likely to pick up again over the next decade. These are the drivers. Our kit is only getting more exquisite, not less so. And so, it seems to me like, yes, we would love to cut the costs. You just don't really see how it could be done, the political will to do it. Because each thing, when you start looking at it individually, becomes radioactive. And so, I mean, it does in the end, like, comes a bit down to, I mean, take personnel, which I oversaw in my last job. It's half the budget of the Pentagon, more or less. Very expensive, growing year on, year out, for lots of different reasons. But right, one of the more interesting ideas, and it cuts across kind of things we've talked about here, is, hey, people should be replaced with things, that are less expensive in the long run than people are. Especially if you do the life cycle cost of people, right? The VA benefits, et cetera, on the back end of this, which we don't factor in, but that's $150 billion a year the VA is spending on behalf of our service members. So I don't have an answer to you other than it seems to be kind of an ever-receding goal that we're going to contain costs.
I will give you what I think is the single most stunning statistic in our report, is that according to Army estimates, this is the Army's own numbers, it has 33% excess base capacity. It doesn't need a third of the bases that it has. That would be great money to be investing in greater combat capabilities and to be, buying things, but Congress will not entertain a round of BRAC, of the base realignment and closures. We felt so strongly about this that even though we know the political situation today does not support that, one of our recommendations is for the senior Army leaders to just keep beating that drum in the hopes that the political context will change. But that is really above the Army's and really the military's pay grade as a whole. But they have to keep pointing out the incredibly stupid wastes of money that come from that in the hopes that someday it will take.
And part of it may be trying to get more out of what we have. There are a lot of people in the U.S. military today, right, who aren't war fighters. Those are people who are open for being, replaced with a civilian worker, for example, and try to get more of the active component strength kind of, on the front lines. Just the most amazing statistic for me, I'm writing a piece on military health system reform. 1 in 3 O6s in the military are in the medical corps. 1 in 3. These are folks who do heroic work, and their commitment to our service members is unquestioned. But you think to yourself, there might be a different model for that that could take some of those billets and put them in the infantry. And, we might be better off in all respects.
Okay. All right. Let's take a few more questions. There in the gentleman with the red tie.
Chris Reed, recently retired after 30 years in the Army. And I would like to explore more this idea you mentioned about the hybrid brigade, getting more Army out of the Army through integration of the reserves. And I ask this because in my last 2 years, I was the senior U.S. liaison at British Army headquarters. It was a good job. And they are struggling with this same issue of integration of their reserve components. They have these hybrid units. I can show you rifle companies that had 2 regular platoons and 1 reserve platoon. And in forms much like this, there's a lot of concern that rather than have and develop a true reserve to bulk up the force in case of crisis, major conflict, what they created was a class of part-time regulars, slightly less well-trained, less capable, showed up less often so they could stretch their pound sterling. So I'd be interested in your thoughts on how we don't go down the road of ending up with a degraded force that just shows up on the patch chart less to save us money.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. I don't think I would compare the British system with our system. From what I know, I know a fair bit on our National Guard and our Army Reserve. We also don't take those units down to that level. We when you take a look at our wiring diagram chart, you're basically battalions are intact as all National Guard, all active Army. We do in the multi-type companies in the Brigade Engineer Battalion, we have different types of companies. Same thing in the Brigade Support Battalion because they tend to fall up under these other units. So we are retaining some pretty big chunks of organization. So you know, Combined Arms Battalion might be all active and would train as an active duty battalion. It would be very high readiness. Its next door neighbor might be all National Guard. But they would, you know, they would have a lot of synergy from being able to work together during this time. Now, this unit we would suggest is going to be more rapidly deployable, more ready, more capable than a pure unit that's all National Guard. And that's presumably the alternative on the British model. All territorials is going to have a much lower readiness. So there's some, we think, some tremendous synergy. There's some cost savings, and there's some better effectiveness in integrating these components into one army. One of the other big report recommendations we have in here. That'll be interesting to see how it plays out. We heard a version of it a week or so ago at the Reserve Forces Policy Board. Is we recommend sourcing all routine deployments that are non-combat deployments with reserve and guard forces first. And so to take the right now, if you've got a brigade rotating to Kuwait, an armored brigade, it's almost always going to be active component. Korea armored brigade combat team active component. Same thing now with Eastern Europe, although we're starting to look at guard units to do that. So we think there's ways to, again, bring this force together in a lot more coherent way and have these hybrid units be at higher readiness than a pure National Guard unit, somewhat less readiness than a pure active duty unit, but also a lot less cost than a pure active duty unit.
The counterpart recommendation to this, and this is for the medium term, this isn't something that's going to happen today, is although we're sure that they would still remain as legal entities, to stop thinking of a distinction between the active component and the reserve component, and instead think of all of the forces you have available, all of the 980,000 people, in terms of deployment timeline, right? So there's going to be your early deployers. You know, we said up to the first 4 months, but pick your number, pick your cut point, right? The people, and we called that the rapid response force. So that's going to consist of most of your people who are on active duty today, right? You have to pay the readiness premium for them to be ready to go that early in the deployment timeline. But frankly, you can't get everybody in the active component out the door that fast today anyway. So it's sort of confusing why you're paying the readiness premium to keep all active units when you can't get them there necessarily fast enough. So then you have another chunk after 4 months. I think we picked about 10 months, but again, you know, pick your cut point, which are the, you know, the next tranche of deployers. Those are units you have 4 months plus to get up to the training level, because you have to assume in this that there's some emergency and that resources are flowing so you can, you know, do the training and the mobilization to get people up to this. We call that the operational response force. And our idea is that many of these hybrid brigades would live there. They'd be at a higher level of readiness. They're not going to be ready to go out the door in the first 4 months, but the folks in these units, the reservists, would have a higher training day commitment, up to 60 days a year, maybe even in some specialties. You could look at increasing that. So you could get them ready in the 4 to 10 month period to go out the door. And then you would still have your deployers who come later on. That would be the more traditional guard and reserve units. And in the case of the next big war, whatever new units you have to create quickly, that you know you're not going to get out the door within the past 10 months. You know, our estimate is you could save a lot of readiness dollars in what today goes to the active component, because you can't get the whole force out the door in 4 months anyway. You put some of that towards these hybrid BCTs, and you still have full coverage of your deployment needs, but you reallocate the money differently so that you get a higher level of readiness. We're not suggesting these things are the first deployers. That would be, you can't do that. But you can maintain them at a higher level of readiness and have save some of the money by rethinking about how you use the force in this way.
Okay. There's a gentleman in the back.
Good morning, John Dowdle. I'm with the Army National Guard Strategic Plans and Policy Division. So this has been a very interesting conversation for the good major and I this morning. Two-part question. Number one, I know right now that the Army Guard is having to look I think one of the things we're looking at is having a brigade activated every year for either rotational to Europe or different things, as well as other, you know, type of filling gaps with the COCOMs and those kind of things. So those are things we're starting to do the sausage making with, which also I think one of the issues that we ran into in the last 10 years during mobilizations was it took us 4 or 5, 6 years to really come up with a good mobilization model. I think is one of the things they're looking at is that especially if we have to gen up very fast, if we have already a current mobilization system that we currently regularly basically activate, that it will be able to do a lot more of that in the future. So those are things we're starting to do from that perspective. The second question, I guess, more is on your security force mission. You know, you brought up Iraq and Afghanistan, but there are some successful models out there. I mean, all these are long, security force sense to me is long-term focus, which I think Army sometimes has an issue with. But I just some comments on some of the successful models out there. One I'm thinking of like right now is probably Colombia. You know, we've been there for decades, but you know, we can probably show a success there, but it was long-term. So it's just some comments. Maybe CENTCOM needs to talk to SOUTHCOM on doing that on limited resources or something. So anyway, thank you.
Just a quick comment on your first point there on the readiness model itself. The Army's gone from the Army Force Generation Model, R4Gen, to a sustainable readiness model, SRM, and they're still tinkering with trying to find what's the right answer. You know, the R4Gen was built for the wars. It was built for Iraq and Afghanistan, rotations that were predictable, or you know, a little bit more sometimes than others than we expected. It took us up to 15 months at one point in time in both theaters, but that was built absolutely for those wars. It's not the right model for the current environment, we don't think. And during that time, we also saw the Guard and Reserve go to, go to a 1-to-2 optimal rotation, you know, boots on the ground to dwell time, Guard and Reserve at about a 1-to-5. There's some talk of whether that ought to be 1-to-4. You know, the previous National Guard chief put that on the table in a letter a couple years ago. But the reality is we're seeing right now is those units are coming up to full readiness at the end of their, you know, 5 years of preparations, and in some cases the Army's not using that readiness in those guard brigades and other units that have gone through year after year of preparation. When it comes time to deploy somewhere, we've seen in the last couple of years that many times the Army has sent an active unit to fill that billet because they didn't have the money allocated to bring the guard unit onto active duty for that period of time. And so that creates all kinds of cascading bad effects for the guard units, as you know, from reenlistment to why did I spend 4 or 5 years training up for this when I didn't get to go, to what is this really a good model for us at all. So we do think this idea of actually resourcing those, not throwing that readiness out the window when you build it, actually using it in these predictable rotations would be a major change that the Army ought to consider. The Air Force actually has done a good bit of that in the last 5 years. That's kind of been their model on going to reserve component first, then active. We think the Army ought to take a hard look at that as well.
Just one point on the rotational demands too. We think that 1-to-5 needs to be reconsidered again, as had been mentioned. You know, if we went to a 1-to-4 rotation policy, and we've heard from we talked to a number of adjutant generals in the states who say that they support this, that they believe that they can support a 1-to-4 mobilization policy. You get 15% more operational capability like that. Now there may be other issues, but that would be a huge gain. Right, so that needs to be systematically looked at to really assess the pros and cons, because if that is workable and what the tags were telling us is right, you gain 15% more capacity overnight with not a great deal more expenditure of resources.
There's someone in the second row, I believe, has a question.
Hi, Courtney McBride with Inside the Army. Your report discusses a need to dedicate some more resources to advanced technologies. And I'm just curious for your sense of the Army's level of commitment to doing this and ability to do this through the RACC Capabilities Office or other means.
I think one of the hallmarks of the report is that we talk technology, but this isn't really, when we talk future Army, it's not about technology. You know, we emphasize the point, as does the Army leadership often, that we're trying to actually use technology to make humans more effective, not necessarily to replace humans out there in a battlefield, particularly in the close fight and hard points. So we do have a lot of examples of how we think that can be done better. We talk about particularly a training revolution in a sense that goes more to virtual reality. We talk about how to use artificial intelligence to get that more embedded in our future battle staff processes to be able to move more rapidly and take some of the human numbers crunching and thinking out of the loop on that. So there are a number of issues on that. In the near term, I think the Army is challenged again with this issue of budgets. What kind of a modernization budget are you going to have? What are you going to put those dollars against? Is it adequate to the threats you have out there? We point out right at the beginning of the report that, you know, the Reagan defense build-up, the big five that the Army put out there on the ramps and in the motor pools in the 1980s, is going to be out there in the ramps and the motor pools in 2035. Because there aren't any programs behind, you know, the Bradley fighting vehicle right now. There's not a program of record behind the M1 Abrams tank or the Apache helicopter. So there isn't enough in the near-term modernization to replace these. So we actually predict that they'll be out there and have to be used and upgraded and tweaked out into 2030s, maybe even the 2040s. That's a huge hole, a huge problem that we think the Army's got to address. And we do point out some specific technological counters out there that we're seeing with what the Russians are doing with their Armada armored vehicle program with active protection, a whole lot of capabilities we don't even have with our vehicles right now, what we're seeing in terms of their ability to use precision weapons and drones that are affecting air defense. Used to be something we gave to the Air Force in the last 10 or 15 years. It's going to probably have to come back to the Army again and come up with some more sophisticated air defense systems that deal with, you know, swarming drones and other things that we haven't experienced. So the whole battlefield is changing there, and I don't think, frankly, the Army modernization is keeping up with it right now. It's making some moves in the right places, but there aren't enough resources to get what the Army really needs there.
Brad, do you want to address this?
No, I mean, modernization funds are always the first cut, right, when the Department of Defense suffers from top-line decreases, and the Army especially, since they're less reliant on expensive kit than the other services are. I think Dave kind of outlined what the future is. Electronic warfare, of course, the only thing I would add to that list as being something I think important for the Army. So I think it's a challenge, right? The Army has not been successful in the last 15 years. Your report talks a lot about kind of the failed acquisition strategies. They're not always the top dollar amounts, but the Army has more failures, more kind of catastrophic failures than are seemingly found in other services. And so, I mean, I think there's a lot of work to be done trying to think through what we need, how to set requirements, and how to execute, even if we had the money.
Okay. Next questions. I have a couple additional questions here for you all. You mentioned additional technologies and capabilities. You know, everyone's talking about cyber wars, cyber capability right now with the U.S. military. Talk about how the Army as an organization fits into the overall U.S. cyber response, and is this, to what extent is this a specialty warfighting skill that the Army needs to improve or to acquire?
We think it's very important. We do talk about that in the report. Cyber is, so ubiquitous now in every aspect of life that, of course, there's going to be an Army role in it. One of the interesting things that we point out, though, beyond dealing with the electronic warfare and the possibility for jamming and protecting the networks, all those things are important. The U.S., a problem much bigger than the Army, the U.S. is very vulnerable to some sort of cyber attack on our civilian infrastructure. There's no question about that. You just think about the possibility of someone hacking in and taking down major power grids in cities or other critical infrastructure. At first glance, that doesn't sound like an Army responsibility, and mostly it won't be. Mostly any sort of response to an event like that will be civilian-led. But one of the things that we point out in the report is that the Army Reserves, and particularly the Army National Guard, can play a very important role in helping protect government networks, particularly state and local networks, which are more vulnerable than federal networks and usually can provide easy access for people because they're more vulnerable to tunnel into federal networks. The California National Guard has done some wonderful experimentation, and a couple of other states' National Guards as well, of providing voluntary services to state and local authorities to come in, scrub their networks, detect vulnerabilities, and offering that on a voluntary basis to the private sector. They're not going to impose that. They don't have the ability to. But if the private sector comes to them and says, you know, please come help us defend our networks, they have the authorities in place to be able to do that. So we think that cyber, it's got to be integrated into everything that the Army does. But at this broader national level, that the Army National Guard in particular is going to play a critical role in helping protect the nation as a whole against some of the cyber issues that we're looking at in the future, and that really is something that they should take on as a greater role.
This also gets right to some of the issues that Undersecretary Carson worked at when he was in OSD, looking at Force of the Future, transforming the personnel system. You know, one of the most difficult characters to recruit and retain in the United States Army is a cyber warrior, and it is in all the military services. All the services are trying to get cyber people in the door. And they're competing with, top talent in industry to do that. So I think we actually cited an example in here of what a career path might be for one of these cyber warriors. They might come in out of school for 2 years, you know, spend their time. I'm not sure they're the people that are going to be crawling under barbed wire and machine gun fire, you know, before they get in front of their keyboard, you know, up at Fort Meade somewhere. So we might want to, and we've written a little bit about that in some of our columns as well in terms of cyber, what a cyber warrior ought to look like and how they ought to be trained and what models we ought to have for them. But then they ought to be able to step back out into the civilian world. They ought to stay in the reserves. We went out to Silicon Valley twice in the last 2 years. In each visit, we found numbers of people who wanted to serve their country out there. They didn't necessarily want to enlist for 4 years and, you know, go through basic training at Fort Benning and have, you know, machine gun fire overhead. And I'm not sure that's where they would provide the greatest right. value. But we haven't figured out a way within a fairly rigid personnel system to bring them on board, keep them engaged, let them step in, step out, let them, you know, be cyber warriors on Tuesday nights and Wednesday nights and Thursday nights in the Army National Guard, and then be on their job and, you know, their startup company, you know, Saturday, Sunday, and the rest of the week. So there's got to be some better ways to be able to do that, because we're not going to fundamentally be able to pay them what they're going to make in the private sector. That's the challenge of active duty cyber warriors. But the folks in the Guard and Reserve aren't doing it for paychecks, frankly. And the ones in Silicon Valley that are connected in there want to do it because they get to do cool things. They don't get to do at work sometimes because it's not legal. And they also get to, you know, serve their country in a way that's very important to them while sure. still maintaining their life and their civilian career and other things. It's almost a perfect model in our view for the Guard and Reserve, but we still have to tweak our personnel system to make that a little bit more easy to get into, stay in, and be able to function in both capacities at the same time.
Let me just add one bit to that. So I think their recommendations in this are particularly exciting, kind of what you envision for that. But, you know, cyber is just kind of, to me, the paradigmatic example of a field we know is really important, but no one in the room actually understands, you know, what it is. I mean, there are many fields like that that will dominate the future of warfare. And where you find the kind of people who are going to be expert in this is going to be a real challenge for us. I remember when I became Undersecretary of the Army, I asked a question that had been on my mind for a while. I said, you know, I went, why do we have an Army Cyber Command? Why can't we have just like everybody be part of a single Cyber Command? Something specific about the Army? And so I was talking to Ed Cardone, then the very able head of Army Cyber Command. And, you know, it's very true. The Army needs its own cyber warriors because they're going to be tactically deployed down to very small units. But it's very different than what the Air Force might need or what the Navy might need. And so the Army needs its own kind of people who are trained to do it. If that's the question, if that's true, which I think it is, where do you get them? It's very difficult to recruit them. We don't pay what you would want. And so the National Guard and the Reserve is going to have to play a huge, huge role in those kinds of skills and in similar fields to cyber. That's where the skills are going to really be. And the third point about that, because this is something I actually had a top-ranking general at the Pentagon raise to me. We were fighting for Force of the Future and some of these changes. So we should just hire all these people in as civilians. You know, we don't need them to be in uniform at all. And I said, well, there's two reasons, right? We want them to be in uniform. And it's important to remember this for me. That one is we have greater flexibility if you're in uniform, right? You can be at Google during the week and in the U.S. Army on the weekend. The second is if you're actually going to be doing any kind of kinetic operations, you need to be in uniform to be protected by the law of war. If you're a GS-14 doing kinetic operations, right, you're not a privileged combatant in those kinds of roles. And so when you get to the kind of high-end tailored access operations and this kind of stuff, right, we need military people who have these kind of skills, right? Civilians are not a substitute at the sharp end of the spear for people who wear the uniform. And so these are skills we're going to have to acquire more of. And I think it's going to be a great challenge for us. You talk to Ed Cardone, all the really the cyber command generals across the services, they're actually very bullish they're going to be able to fill their ranks. You know, they're still now setting up all these national mission teams. They're very bullish that they're going to be able to do it. Although I myself am a bit of a skeptic. More interestingly to me, though, is if they are able to fill them, are they going to be able to keep them? That, I think, is actually going to be a challenge that will be perhaps a bridge too far for us.
I think there's a question in the front row here.
Hi, Richard Lackman, Army War College. Excuse me. Now, I missed the very beginning of your presentation. I apologize. But I just, as I listened to the parts I did hear, and one of the things in the back of my head is you've given us a lot of great ideas about things to consider going forward. But I'm also sort of curious if there are some things looking back. Are there models of how the Army, the U.S. Army in particular, or maybe other militaries or other services in the U.S. or elsewhere, address some of these problems successfully? In other words, models of addressing some of these that we might hearken back to. And one that I thought of, maybe the Big Five was mentioned, but that was kind of focused on a very specific foe in a very particular context. But if there's something more like that that we could think of in terms of models where we've been successful to address some of the challenges you've laid out.
I think the one that we note in the report briefly that I'm very big proponent of is thinking about the next big war. And we actually went back and we looked at some of the writing from the Army War College in the 1930s on the Rainbow Plans and how the Army was preparing with an Army that was a shadow of today's incredible Army, and that had the Major Eisenhowers who got to be majors for 15 years and things like that out of that force, how they used that time when they didn't have the resources, they didn't have tanks, they didn't have the full force structure, they didn't even have a threat in front of them that was clear, to actually think about how they would mobilize a global army to fight a global war. And had they not done that in the 30s, I'm not sure what 1939, 1940, 1941 would have looked like, you know, given how that threat materialized and the U.S. got pulled into it fairly rapidly. So that opportunity to use these times, we also note that we're not in an interwar period, in effect, right now. We're in an at-war period that's going to be a perpetual war period. And so a lot of that institutional energy and thinking and ferment that Mr. Carson mentioned is also devoted to fighting your current wars, trying to figure them out, trying to prevail in those. And you don't have as much time to sit back, reflect, begin to plan and think about future wars and preparing a force to be able to fight in a much different environment 10 or 15 or 30 years from now. I worry about that. I don't think the Army is devoting enough time to thinking about that today. We suggest there are some specific things they ought to be doing to get ready for that now, because if that rolls on top of the United States at some point in the next 5 years or so, we're going to be psychologically and probably material unprepared to deal with that.
I'm more concerned. I think that there are models to look back to, and we mentioned the cohort program as unit stabilization and some of the benefits from that as one of our models that might be looked into in a particular area in the report. But more broadly, I'm concerned about the flip of your problem, in that the Army has a great reverence for its tradition, and much of that is good. The warrior ethos, the fighting spirit, much of that is good. But the downside of that is there is a tendency to look back at things that didn't work in the past and say, well, then they don't work. Okay? I was on a panel at AUSA last year with a number of generals and put out this idea about hybrid brigades. It wasn't quite as fleshed out as it is now. But I said, for the same reason, we need to get more capability, we need to be looking into hybrid brigades. And immediately what came up is what always comes up from Army audiences, which is, well, round out didn't work, therefore it can't work. And I nearly went apoplectic. You can find the video online. I felt much more enraged than I actually looked like. And I said, that is not an acceptable answer. Like, and it's debatable whether it was a success or not, or whether there were some decisions that were made. But put that aside. Even if you accept it was a total disaster, that was going on 30 years ago, right? Why are we in a whole different environment? We cannot afford to reject things that didn't work well in the past simply because they didn't work well in the past. And the Army culture tends to do a lot of that. My argument there and as now is, look, I don't care if this is the right answer or not, but you have to question all of your assumptions. The Army, the environment is changing so rapidly, so quickly. The Army is not a nimble and agile organization at the institutional level, in the field very much so, but not at the institutional level. And so I think it's imperative for all Army leaders, this goes to some of the culture, to question all assumptions and say, really do the no-kidding analysis, not to reject things from the front. The three-star general on the panel said to me when I brought this up, some guy before me, and he's a good guy, I like him, he's a smart thinker. He said, some guy before me decided that it was wrong, so I don't want to question his judgment. And I said, I'm sorry, but those stars on your shoulder mean that it's your responsibility to question that judgment and to go back to core assumptions and to investigate all of these things. The Army has to do a lot of adapting, and I think that its culture is going to have to change to start questioning those kinds of assumptions.
It's a hard thing. The poet and historian Robert Conquest once said that everyone's reactionary about the thing they know most about. And that's very true. There is, if you're an expert in something, if you've lived it for 30 years, right, there is an incredible conservatism that comes with that, right? And I think it's the challenge. And I think there are examples, whether it's the Marines, amphibious warfare that they did, the Army in the 70s with the airland battle that led to the big five programs that you talk about in your program. But to me, the challenge, having sat at the top of the Army, is they need a coherent conception of what the future of war is going to look like for them. I remember sitting in many meetings, we're discussing the need for a new fighting vehicle, the ground combat vehicle was on its kind of last legs of program. And it was actually a good debate, like, where do you want the armor to be? The top, the side, or the bottom? Well, that depends, right? What's the war going to look like? That's you tell me about the war, the North, you know, the Russians need a different kind of armor configuration than if it's Afghanistan or Iraq Mark II. I mean, these are the kind of questions, right, you have to have some coherence about. And I think that's the challenge, that you look at successes, air-land battle is one, very defined enemy. You know, Depew and people like that, right, they walk the battlefields, you know, for years at a time, a trade-off, thinking through these kinds of questions. We don't have a clear enemy, really, to think through what the strategic needs are going to be about. And that's a hard thing for us. That's why I think one of the great, really the most important things that's happened, a little unnoticed at the Pentagon the last couple of years, is the reinvigoration of wargaming. You know, really trying to get this thinking through. We're wargaming, you're testing, you're seeing where gaps exist. H.R. McMaster is doing a lot of this. It's also happening at the OSD level. I mean, that's how you kind of get to these kind of situations, right? You're gaming it out and you see where you fail. And that's where innovations happen. I mean, there's a vast literature, which I'm sure you know, about innovation in the military. It's a hard thing, right? And it usually happens on the fly in wartime when demands are extremely pressing. To do it in peacetime, you know, there aren't that many models to choose from. There are a few, and we should try to learn the lessons from those few.
Okay, we have 3 minutes, so I'm going to take 3 final questions very quickly all together, and then you all can answer in one sentence if that's possible. Okay, and the gentleman in the purple, and the gentleman in the front row, and the second gentleman in the front row. If you could ask, just be fairly brief.
Hi, my name is Chris Bowers. I work in the Office of the Secretary of the Army. We've spoken a lot today about the sort of ongoing perpetual war, the high demand for Army Special Operations Forces. The Joint Force, the Geographic Combatant Commanders, also have a high demand for a lot of the non-combat enablers, headquarters units to form the cores of JTFs, the exact kind of units and formations that would normally provide some of the trade space in order to plus up our, you know, the tooth-to-tail ratio and more into the BCTs. You've discussed some of the trades that recommended for that, but in terms of being able to sort of message to combatant commanders, to the Joint Force, to Congress, and other outside entities that may not appreciate the delicate balance between the requirements of the current fight, which will be going on into the future, while the potential fight against Russia or other peer adversaries is going on, versus the need to prepare for that in terms of rebuilding the force and also technological advancement. How can we do a better job in the Army of telling that story and making clear the trade-offs we're trying to make and the balance we're trying to find?
Okay, the gentleman here in the front, and I'm going to ask each of one person take one question.
Chuck Allen, U.S. Army War College. Next week, we're going to teach our students about organizational culture and leading change. So one of the things about changing culture is to have a compelling case or crisis to use up front. Have we made that case as something is so untenable in our Army structure so far, we're doing business in order to make those changes? And who's responsible for influencing and directing that change?
Great. And the gentleman over here.
Yeah, I'm Guy Swan from the Association of the U.S. Army, AUSA. I'm not going to give you a question. I'm just going to make a comment here as we close. Your report is phenomenal. I'm encouraged by what I'm seeing as kind of a convergence of thinking on a lot of the issues. The National Commission on the Future of the Army raised a number of the issues you faced. Your report, what General Milley is talking about and what we're hearing from the Guard and Reserve, and I think we're at a true inflection point for the United States Army here as we go forward. So I'm very encouraged by all of these things seemingly coming together at this point.
Okay, we've got 2 questions. It's messaging and organizational culture. Who wants to take which?
I'll take the organizational culture one, if that's okay. Did I cut you off?
No, please.
I couldn't see you while I was looking this way. It actually relates back to something you were just saying, is that, you know, what's the story of the Army going to be? What's the environment of the Army going to be? And the answer is we don't know. I have a lot of sympathy for making those armored decisions because we don't know. But, you know, we write this in the report. When you look out to the world of 2025 to 2040 and beyond, the one thing that is very clear is that the Army is going to have to adhere to the principle of adaptability. We're not going to get it right. We're going to make our best guesses, but we're going to get it wrong because we can't predict the future. So we think the key feature of the future U.S. Army is to be as adaptable as possible at every level. Again, the Army does a great job of this at the tactical level,
But it doesn't do a good job of this at the institutional level and at the broader strategic level. And so I think that that's, you know, when you talk about what does the, doesn't help you talk about how to change the culture, that's an incredibly difficult question, but I think that's where the culture of the entire Army needs to go. The rest of the Army needs to be more like the operational force in that sense, because that's going to be the key attribute that the Army is going to need in the future no matter what.
Okay, and who wants the last word on the how to message?
I'll take the last word myself to double tap what Guy said, which is the report's really terrific. I hope you all have a chance to read it. It's great that the Atlantic Council sponsored this. And you know, what's I think remarkable about it, it has a long list of very specific recommendations, but they're placed holistically about what the Army should look like. You know, there are people in the Army who'll talk about equipping or manning or some kind of particular aspect of it. And I worked with them all the time. The Army has people, as we speak, working those very issues. Very few people, even at the very highest levels, are kind of having this broad view of like, how does this all fit in into the future Army? And that's, I think, what the report does really, really well, and you should commend it for. And so I recommend all of you to kind of look at it and see kind of, you know, what a future Army could look like across the board.
And just on the messaging?
Yeah, very quick messaging. I'm not a fan of the term messaging and the idea of messaging in a lot of ways, and I think we overuse that. I do think that some of these force structure changes are going to actually give the COCOM commanders some reliable forces they're going to have available. I've heard discussion that the advise and assist brigades, or what we call security force assistance brigade, may be tapped to line up with the various COCOMs, and the COCOMs can use them as they wish. That would be a useful thing there. And then I think just to close, to reinforce Ms. Carson's comment here, that you know the report's really designed to provoke thinking. This is designed to cause folks to kind of get out of their institutional boxes and look at the entire picture, not only for what it looks like today, but projecting it out to the middle of this century. And we're all very comfortable with what we've been doing for the last 10 or 15 or 20 years. We believe in the organization. It's an incredible organization. It's been a national asset since the United States Army was formed during the Revolution. But it's got to continue to change. If it doesn't continue to change, it's going to be less capable and less of a contributor to the defense of the nation in the future. And that gets at everything from culture to how you think about what kind of wars you're going to have to do. Again, to double down on Nora's point, it's going to be about adaptability, changing and adjusting, and leveraging all those incredible young men and women in there and making sure their voice gets heard before they get to be, you know, 55 years old in generals.
All right. Well, thanks to the distinguished panelists, and thanks to you all for being here today. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to the Atlantic Council Events Podcast. For more information, please visit our website at atlanticcouncil.org and follow us on Twitter @AtlanticCouncil. The Atlantic Council, working together to secure the future.